So as you begin your meditation, just let yourself settle into your body, feeling a sense of presence here in the room. Actually feeling your body sitting, so you're making contact with your body on the chair or on the cushion or bench. Actually feeling the sensations of pressure or density, hardness. It's a way to help you ground here in this present moment. And gently connecting with your breathing. Breathing in and breathing out. And on the out-breath, releasing and letting go. The way you let go of all that you carried in here. Breathing out and releasing, relinquishing, so that you're not carrying anything, you're not holding. So with the breath, the out-breath, you help soften the places of tension. Places of contraction. Breathing in and then breathing out. In a way, we let go of the past. And gently rest into this present moment, receiving it just as it is. And however it is that you might be experiencing yourself right now, whether you feel energized or you feel tired, you feel interested or you feel some emotion, it doesn't matter what's present. It's just with your awareness, receiving yourself, receiving your experience just as it is. Even in tiredness, it's possible just to make contact with the breathing as a way to help keep a sense of presence and connection. So the breath is our ally in that way. Each time we find ourselves getting distracted or lost, pulled away from this present moment, spacey or whatever it is, we draw ourselves back. And the breath can be a useful way to anchor ourselves back here. So when we let go, this means we let go of our thoughts, our thinking. Not pushing away our thoughts, but when they're present, we have the intention not to follow them right now. But we let them go. And come back into the breathing, into the body, into presence. Thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you. It's very nice to be here, although it is a little bit of an effort since I live near Spirit Rock and I just drove up here tonight. But once I get here and I'm part of your Sangha, it feels wonderful. And I just wish it was a little bit closer, so because I do have to drive back as well tonight. So, but it's really lovely to be here. And the last time I was here was just a few weeks ago for the installation of the lady. I'm going to call her the lady because I have the worst time with her name, Mahapajapati. Mahapajapati. And when I sat down and reflected on what I wanted to talk about with you tonight, I was still very much in that celebration. When I thought about coming back here, that was the first thing that arose for me, was the power of that evening. And I realized that, in fact, I wasn't finished honoring her and need to do more of that tonight. You were given an amazing gift by having the installation of the statue here a few weeks ago. And I'm just curious, how many people here tonight were not at the installation, if you could raise your hands? Oh, a lot of you. Uh-huh. Good. Good. Well, in a way, then, that it's appropriate to bring some of the evening to you so that you can be part of that with us and really maybe deeply understand what you have here in the other room. By bringing the statue of the lady, it is a way of really honoring the feminine and the and women teaching, which even though there are a number of women teachers, particularly within the Spirit Rock tradition, and within our network of Spirit Rock, Insight Meditation Society, and Gaia House, which are the three sister centers, it's still not necessarily easy to be offering teachings as a woman in a fairly patriarchal tradition of Buddhism. So we as women are working with that conditioning quite a lot, even right now in this 21st century. And by Gil really honoring the bringing of that statue and the whole celebration, the beautiful celebration that happened around the installation, was really a statement, a deep statement for how important it is to really honor the feminine voice, to bring that forth into Buddhist teachings. I wanted to remind you of what the story is for her, and also to fill in a few things that were I felt were left out, a few pieces of information about the story that I felt were left out on that evening, which seemed kind of important to me to bring in and as a way of more deeply honoring her. For those of you who were here, and maybe for those of you who weren't, there was a whole enactment of what happened during the time of the Buddha when Mahapajapati asked the Buddha to open the order of the nuns and the bhikkhunis. And there was a whole performance with a dance and a play and the speaking the words of what happened. And it was very moving, very touching. And then we went out, the men and the women separated. And the women went out and formed a circle. There were quite a few. There were about 75 women formed a circle out there, and the men stayed in here. And we talked out there, and the men talked in here separately, just to see what would come up for us around this celebration. And we had a rehearsal before we came for the celebration, and I was here as one of the women teachers who was part of that celebration. And we watched the rehearsal, and Gil was here. And then we went out to dinner. There were about seven female teachers from both Zen traditions and Vipassana traditions. And at dinner, we talked together about what we thought was left out of the enactment that didn't seem to really fully portray why the Buddha finally decided to allow women into the order of the nuns. And I wanted to bring that piece forth a little bit more tonight to really so we can understand a little bit what actually happened there. So I'll briefly go over the story again for those, and it sounds like maybe a number of you might not even know the story here. Mahapajapati was the sister of the Buddha's mother who died. The Buddha's mother died in childbirth, and it was the sister who brought the Buddha up. She was the foster mother. And the milk mother of the Buddha. But the sister was also married to the king. She was married. The king had both wives of the Buddha's mother and the sister. So when the mother died, she was still the wife of the king in that way. And then after the king died, she began to feel weary of the worldly life. There really wasn't anything there for her. And so she wanted to follow a pure life. And she wanted to follow the Buddha. And the Buddha was the Buddha at that time, and he was teaching, and she wanted to listen to his Dharma talks and be with him, and wish she could leave home and join the group of monks in the practice of the Dharma. This is all that she really wanted. And really, when we reflect on this, her conditioning at the time, and the point I want to bring up more for us tonight, is her conditioning at the time was that she really didn't have any purpose without a husband. As a woman during that time of the history, all of a woman's value and purpose was to the duty of her husband. And when a husband dies and there wasn't really any purpose for being alive, so the lady Mahapajapati requested the Buddha permission to let her and her ladies leave home and become a nun so she could be close to him. She could follow and be close to him. And although she asked him again and again, she was refused three times. And she felt very disappointed and very, very hurt. And she and the women who she was bringing with her, they just would cry and weep. And one of the points that we talked about when we were at dinner together was that we felt that even in the enactment, the performance that was happening, that the depth of the women's pain didn't really come forth. I mean, they were deeply, deeply hurt that they wouldn't be able to sit with the Buddha, to follow the Buddha, to listen to the Buddha's teachings. And they would just weep and cry and weep and cry. So after some time went by, the lady and a group of women just shaved their heads and they put on robes and they began a long journey by foot to where the Buddha was staying. And they walked a very, very long way. And when they arrived, after walking a long time, their feet were swollen, their bodies were thin and weak, and they could not hold back their tears. They just sat and they were weeping and weeping and crying. They were just so exhausted. And at that time, they were right outside the gates of the monastery, and at that time, Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant, main attendant, walked past, asked her why she was crying. Why were the women crying? And she said, "Venerable Ananda, the Buddha did not allow me and my women to leave home, and I want nothing else but to become a nun." You know, she just, that's all that mattered to her. So Ananda told her to wait for a little while and he would go and talk to the Buddha and see what he could do. So he went to the Buddha and with deep reverence he asked him to show his mercy and to let the women leave home as men were allowed to leave home. And of course the Buddha replied, Ananda, no, do not ask me to do this. Do not ask me to do this. But Ananda did not back down. And with courage, he persisted a second time and then a third time. And each time the Buddha refused. He said, no, do not ask me to do this. So this is the point that I'm not sure came through clear enough in the enactment, because what actually happened next was that Ananda thought that he needed to find a way to really get the Buddha to understand why he needed to open an order for nuns. And he said, Lord Buddha, if women quit worldly affairs and become nuns and strictly practice pure living according to the Dharma, will they be able to, if they follow the order of the holy path, will they be able to attain the four fruits? Will they be able to attain Nibbana? And the Buddha replied, Ananda, if women quit worldly affairs, become nuns, and practice according to the Dhamma, they too can, during this present lifetime, attain the stage of Arahant and Nibbana. They too can become enlightened. And so, therefore, Ananda said, well, then I beg you, please consider what the lady has done for you. You know, she's your foster mother, she's your aunt, she breastfed you from the time of your mother's death. Please allow the women to leave home. And then the Buddha said, all right, Ananda, I shall allow her to leave home. So it was really the point of reminding the Buddha that the women too had the capacity to be enlightened. Because during that time, it was actually refuted whether a woman could be enlightened in a female body. And when you read the text, in the ancient text, there is one of the teachings where it says that a woman would actually have to be reborn in a male body to be enlightened, that she couldn't be enlightened in a female body. So here, this is a very controversial point here. So what we went into, after we had the enactment, we went out and we had this women's circle and we talked together about what this was bringing up for us. And one of the things that came up was that the women were angry at the Buddha. They were angry at the Buddha because, you know, why, if the Buddha was so enlightened, then why wouldn't he just see that it was obvious that women should have their own order of the bhikkhunis. And we didn't actually have much time to really discuss in a deep way what might have been going on for the Buddha. But I noticed that mostly what was left with was that anger and some even doubt about the Buddha's enlightenment during that circle. And in myself, what I wanted to point out tonight, because I have a different way of relating to the fact that the Buddha said no. I've spent quite a lot of time in India over the last 15 years. In fact, many of you may know that I was going to India every winter for 15 years to teach in Bodh Gaya with Christopher Titmus, the place where the Buddha was enlightened. And I spent 3 or 4 months almost every year and traveling and talking and getting to know people there. So I have some sense of the culture even now in the 21st century. And the conditioning of women there is so powerful that to have the Buddha agree to have women go into homelessness at the time, you know, 2,500 years ago, would have just been absolutely unheard of. Because women were completely protected by their family. They were completely protected by their husbands. And their role and their value was all in regard to their husband. So having a woman who was off on her own, or even a group of women who were off on their own, were just considered somewhat scandalous. They weren't valued in any way whatsoever. And I wanted to bring out another point, which is a little bit difficult to bring out, but I again want to remind you what the women were really dealing with during that time of the Buddha. This woman who you have in your hall there. I'm reading this novel called The Far Pavilions, and it's about India in early 1800s. And I read this particular section last night, and I think this is probably what partly encouraged me to want to talk about this tonight too, because it was a brief scenario of what women were dealing with, even in the 1800s, let alone 2,500 years ago. And a princess is talking. Her name is Anjuli, and she's a mixed race. She was had an Indian mother and a British father. Or actually, the other way around, doesn't matter. And this is what she says. She was a princess. She says, Anjuli had never, she doesn't say this, this is about Anjuli. Anjuli had never expected very much of marriage. Her future was decided by her half-brother and his favorites, who was now the Maharaja. And there was nothing she could do about it. It seemed to her a gamble in which the dice were heavily loaded in favor of the opposite sex, for no woman could choose her husband. Yet having married him, even though he proved to be cruel and unjust to her, or physically repulsive, she must worship him as a god, serving him and doing his will to her life's end. And if he died before her, then she must immolate herself on his pyre. This is what was happening even in the 1800s, that women were also supposed to go to their death when their husband died, because on the cremation pile, because they had no more value after the husband died. There was The depth of this conditioning is even perhaps hard for us to imagine. It's called sutsuti, and maybe some of you, we can have comments later. It's called sutsuti. And then it goes on, a bridegroom who was disappointed when he lifted his bride's veil and saw for the first time the face of the girl he had married could console himself with other women. But a disappointed bride had nothing but her sense of duty and the hope of children to sustain her. Very, very sad. So this man who she was talking to, Ash, who had British parents but was raised in India as a Hindu, said not to worry about having to go to the pyre with your husband because suti was now forbidden by law. And Julie scoffed. She said, an English law? Have you really become so much of an Englishman that you believe your people have only to say it is forbidden? For such old customs as this to cease immediately? Widows have burned themselves with their husbands for centuries, and the tradition will not die in a day, or a year, or a score of years, at the bidding of the foreigners. In places where there are large numbers of English and police enforce the law, there will be those who will obey. But many others will not, and your Raj will never even know of it, for this is too vast a land for a handful of foreigners to keep watch over. Only when women themselves refuse to submit to this custom will it cease. So I wanted to bring this up because, you know, we can so easily form views about what we think is going on. And, you know, even doubting the Buddha's enlightenment. But I think that, you know, just as in this day of our own history, we don't know what's really going on for people. And until we have information, more information about who we are interacting with, people's customs, people's cultures, we really don't know what's going on behind those veils. And I could see the same thing happening around the Buddha when we were having our women's circle. You know, the views that we're forming without having a deeper understanding of the conditioning that women were really engaged in at that time. So I really want to honor this statue and the presence of Mahapajapati here in this hall, because it was an incredible, courageous act that she made at that time to enter into the life of homelessness with her sisters and live the life of the Dhamma at the time, and then become a real teacher from her own practice and her deep wisdom. I was thinking about my intention too, my deeper intention for wanting to talk about this tonight, and it has something to do too with exploring the ways that we are conditioned to keep ourselves separate from each other. You know, our own issues around diversity, which are really, I mean, particularly at Spirit Rock, these questions are really up for us right now. Spirit Rock is really committed to issues of diversity and looking at ways that we are blinded by our own conditioning in relationship to race and to gender and to age and all the other different categories that we can be prejudiced towards. And how do we keep our hearts open to each other? How do we keep our hearts open so that we listen to each other, we care about each other, we care about finding out about what's really true before we form our views too strongly, too solidly. Just a few days ago, last week, we had a day of diversity at Spirit Rock for the Diversity Council, which is about 20 people of color, and the teachers, Spirit Rock teachers. And we met together for a whole day, and we had a facilitator who facilitated a process with us. And I wanted to share one little piece of something that happened there for me on that day. Well, when we, in the beginning of the day, we did a role play. And what we did was we had two groups of four people who stood up at the top of the at the front of the group, and then a man and a woman who went out and out the room, and we were told to do anything we could when these two people came in, to do anything we could to keep them out of our group, that our group was just our group, and we could do anything we wanted to short of violence to keep them out of our group. And what they were told was to do anything they could to get in our group. So, and then there was a group over there and a group of us over here, and it was kind of gender mixed and race mixed. And so when they came in, we had to figure out some strategy, what we were going to do to keep them out of our group. And one of our group members said, well, let's not do this. You know, why should we keep them out of our group? You know, let's just be loving and open and kind and bring them into our group. We don't need to play this. And then another person in our group said, well, maybe if we do the exercise, we'll learn something. So maybe we should try to keep them out of the group. So we decided to keep them out of the group. So when they came in, they were doing all kinds of things to try to get us to open our group to them. And there was one moment where one of the women who was Latino came up to me, and she said, you know, you can't come in our group because we're talking about something important. And she said, she looked at me, she was standing there and looking at me right in the eyes, and she said, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, we're talking about how to keep you out of the group. And there was just kind of this standoff. And there was just a moment where I looked in her eyes and she looked in my eyes. And the way that I kept it going was I just kept saying to myself, well, this is just a game. This is just an exercise. This is just a game. But for that minute, it wasn't even a minute, it was like 10 seconds, where she looked in my eyes and I looked in her eyes and I defiantly said, you know, we're talking about how to keep you out of the group. In that moment, it wasn't a game anymore. It was like that fine line between reality and what's an illusion or a game. It just dropped away. And we were just there together, and it felt very real. It's like it was her and it was me. It all just dropped away. And then we ended it, and then we talked about the whole thing that went on and what was our mind state about how we could carry on believing that it was important to keep them out of our group. What was it? What was that inner attitude that we could lock into that said, yeah, let's keep doing this and let's treat them in a way that they don't deserve to be in our group? And it was very revealing in many ways for us. We went one by one and talked about our experience along the way. And I think what I really learned from it was that moment was so poignant that this is reality. You know, there is no game. There is no game in this. We can think that we might be playing games or, you know, be humorous or, you know, whatever it is that we rationalize. But this is real. We're talking about real human beings who have real pasts and real conditioning and real tenderness and fragility and cultural background. And when we start to just soften a bit, to sensitize ourselves a bit, to start communicating and listen and talking together, it's quite remarkable what can start happening as we meet each other and sense those, what it's like as those boundaries, those barriers of separation start to just melt away a little bit, even if it's for a couple of minutes, where we're really right there together. And there's a human being, and here's a human being. And we want to understand each other. We want to know each other. So I think that also for me, the statue represents that whole kind of invitation to diversity, to a hearing from each of us about what our own individual truth is. And having that quality of openness and sensitivity, that encouragement for us all, that we keep exploring these ways that we create these barriers of separation in ourselves. So I want to open it up just a little bit. We only have about 10 minutes or so. And just hear if there's any comments or anything that you want to bring forth tonight about anything that I said or anything I might have said that was incorrect too. Yes.
Uh-huh. Actually, I have two comments. One is, in Buddha's time, women were perhaps very downtrodden. I don't believe they're necessarily as downtrodden as in the 1800s, because the whole practice of sati happened with the Muslim invasion. There were a lot of mass rapes of women, and women really got with the veil under protection. All that happened after the Muslim invasion.
And when was that?
700 AD. And second point is, even if we consider that women were very downtrodden at that time, and was one of the reasons he didn't out they protected, he didn't want to bring them out, shock everybody, maybe put them in dangerous way to make them nuns without protection of men. There was the untouchable caste, which was completely out of the pale of the society. They were treated like animals. Even their shadow on a Brahmin was considered polluting. And he made no exception. Buddha didn't keep them out for their protection. I mean, the amount of violence that was directed, and even yesterday in some places, mm-hmm. towards a person of an untouchable caste if he goes to a temple, mm-hmm. from time to time, not always, is very significant. So Buddha didn't feel it necessary to keep them out, but he kept women out. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is kind of sad and surprising. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe, I mean, we all know, even in today, India is not the only place, nor is Buddhism the only place, or Hinduism the only place where women are kept from important positions in the religion. Mm-hmm. And why should we not get angry? Mm-hmm. And why should we not expect the best? Mm-hmm. Why do we necessarily need our ideals to be absolute perfection? That's why people created God, but, you know, I mean, do we need a perfect God to worship? Does Buddha need to be that absolute perfection? Mm-hmm. Can he have certain yes. human qualities?
Yes.
And maybe mm-hmm. we can appreciate the fact that in spite of his reservations, he did. And that's something to
yes.
He did allow them in. He did let go. Yes. Whatever that last vestige of crimping he had in his heart.
Yes. Yes, yes. Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying, and thank you for the clarification of those historical facts as well. Now, I think it's really important what you're saying, that it's okay to get angry, you know, and to feel the feelings we feel about that and the way that we understand that. And also to appreciate that the Buddha did let go, you know, right at the end. And I think each one of us, as we find out more and more information, each one of us have our own responses, and those are important for us to have. Yeah. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What this discussion brings up for me is a sense of frustration with an absolute concept of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I think the notion that any person at any time, be it the Buddha or Christ or anybody else, had a perfect view of the world, it's just too extreme for me. And so the Buddha could have reached a state where he'd recognized many things which people around him hadn't recognized, and by teaching he could propagate those things. To call that enlightenment is fine, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make him into a perfect person.
Yes.
And that here's a place where he hadn't recognized something, mm-hmm. which he later then accepted and said, well, maybe we can try it in that direction. Even though, as was discussed later, he continued to maintain restrictions on the women and maintain them at a lower status than all the men who were monks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Again, partly because of what he felt the reaction of the society around mm-hmm. would be.
Yeah.
The notion that to be enlightened is to be perfect mm-hmm. is somehow strange to me.
Well, I think you're making a very good point because, it does, there's a certain implication that when one is fully enlightened, they also have an enlightened view of the world. And the world is the conditioned reality, the conventional reality in which we live, which is where the personality still exists. You know, we never get rid of our character, of our personality. Even the Buddha had a personality. You know, and we never fully overcome that cultural conditioning, which is what the Buddha was responding to. That always is part of our character. But the question then is, well, then what does the enlightenment mean? What does the enlightenment mean? And I think it's a very, very important question, so that we, in a way, we're not confusing apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. That oranges don't become apples in enlightenment. You know, it's like, what are we really talking about here? That's a very important point. Does anybody want to comment? Yes.
A perspective that helps me understand this story is that of archetypal integration of deep masculine and deep feminine. Because Ananda's role was to point out that Buddha as a human being received his nurturing and his exposure to the deep feminine from Ajahnipani, and that his sense of it is enough, that I am fully masculine and deep masculine, we've pointed out that that is not enough. That the real integration of self as an evolving enlightenment of the conditioned self, that requires acknowledging the role of the deep feminine in bringing that form of teaching, and that the deep masculine teaching is not itself enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be charitable, if you will, to him as the story relates, the Buddhist's own personal development.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I think that is one model, one way we can view that. No. And the Buddha was in a masculine body, and there was
the culture was strongly masculine.
The deep feminine kind of spiritual teachings was not present overtly at the time. So all those influences are going to make a difference in how people respond to different situations. So I think that is a helpful frame for people who resonate with that kind of a view. I think that is, yes.
Part of what's coming up for me as I'm listening to all of this discussion is a sense of, and it made me feel relieved when I heard the woman talk about, you know, why do we expect someone to be enlightened to be perfect and completely removed from all conceptual reality? And when I even hear the concept of enlightenment, it throws me back to my days. I often refer to myself as a recovering perfectionist. Right, in this sort of Western puritanical culture that I was raised in. And part of what's been so attractive and so refreshing to me about Buddhism has been that I don't feel that most of the tenets encourage trying to reach someplace else, like enlightenment as a goal, but that it's about being with what's here. Even if it is struggling with role identification or, you know, the attachment of value based on gender or whatever it is, it's about being with it, not judging it, or not necessarily even making it get to some other place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure exactly. I probably have not studied enough in Buddhist texts to know what it even means to be enlightened, but I'm assuming it means that the one has gotten very good at being what is.
I like that. So let's reflect on that. So enlightenment could be getting very good at being present with what's present at any given time. Hmm? Yeah, I think that's a fairly enlightened view. Unfortunately, a lot of people, even within the Buddhist tradition, have the sense of striving for something called enlightenment. No, there's, you know, one of the factors on the Eightfold Path is called wise effort. And that it's very important for us to understand what is meant by wise effort, because what you're talking about really falls within that. Because if we can really understand where the imbalance is in our striving, it can help us relax back into the what isness, and that is a doorway for us. It's an opening for us to true awakening. Yeah. I guess we just take a couple more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a bit of a problem with your statement, just because I think that takes too passive a view. I mean, one of the things that we discussed that night of the celebration was not just what was going on in Buddhist time, but also presently how women in Buddhism are treated, women nuns, that they follow a different set of rules still now. So enlightenment is to sit and be what is going on right now. It doesn't give me hope for things that are going to change. And I think that there's still a pervasive attitude, not just in Buddhism, but also in other religions, as to how women are treated, whether or not it was in the time of the Buddha or even now. And I think that could be just isn't something that I can deal with. I mean, in terms of the Buddha, one point you made was that Mahabhagavati was very brave, very courageous for what she did, and that we should understand that. I think I understand that. What I don't understand still is the Buddha's reaction. Mm-hmm. And now, with this discussion, I understand it more, but then I bring it up to the present time, mm-hmm. and I say, why do Buddhist monks, or why does this, you know, in certain ways, women are still treated unequally?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I have to step back and listen to the point that this woman made, which was that we do have to remember that even in enlightenment, it doesn't mean you're perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm taking away today.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Good. It's and that's a question about why is it continuing? Why is the treatment continuing? It's a very important question that's often brought in many circles, Buddhist circles, with women. I want to say something about your point about the difference between just sitting and being with what is, and then seeing that nothing is really changing, and then taking some action to make something change. And I'm wondering, I want to question whether they actually need to be set up as a duality or whether they can both exist at the same time. Yeah. So that they're not, those two things are not necessarily opposed to each other. It's not like an either or. It's not like we either sit with what is or we get out and we take action to try to make something change. But that the teachings of the Buddha are always pointing to the middle way. Always pointing to the middle way. So anytime we set something up as opposite or extreme, then we need to come to the middle to see how they can be held together so that we collapse the duality. We continue to keep collapsing any duality that we create in our mind and come to the middle where we're holding it all. So nothing is left out of that circle. Yes.
I think this is a great question. It's one that I struggle with a lot. And one way that I made peace with it for myself is that part of what's true, the condition exists and coming to terms with and acceptance of that is one thing. But another piece of what's true is whatever I might feel about that. And if there's a great deal of pain, then I think my job as I sit is to sort of let all corners be heard from inside. And if there's a great deal of pain, that quiet and silence is a place for that pain to arise where it might have been paved over before.
Mm-hmm.
So coming out of denial is part of the purpose of sitting for me.
Yeah, beautiful. And coming out of that denial, it's quite likely then something's going to change. it's in that place of the hidden places within ourselves that we don't see, that we don't know about, that there can't be any movement, there can't be any change. And then the effect of that, the wider effect of that is quite huge. We are colluding together in not allowing something to change. So it's so important what you say about bringing that which is painful into consciousness, bringing it up into awareness so that we can see it, we can hold it, we can love it, we can do whatever we need to do with it. That's where something's going to make a difference. We end around 9, don't we? Yeah. Well, thank you for bearing with me as I continue to honor the women's teaching, women's voice, and again, honoring your center. This is a very important sangha. Very important sangha in North America now. You've got a lot of energy that's rising here, and you're making a statement. You're making a difference in Western Buddhism. So thank you very much, and I hope to see you again. Good night.